CityTalk 105.9 official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. CityTalk 105.9.
Hello and welcome to City Talks Business with me, Frank McKenna. I'm the chairman of the Independent Private Sector Lobby Group and Business Networking Club Downtown Liverpool in Business, and every Sunday we look at some of the week's big business stories and talk to some key personalities, decision makers and entrepreneurs who work in and influence Liverpool and the wider Northwest region. This week we are taking a look at women in business, more specifically a government report that has been produced highlighting the difficulties and barriers females face in the workplace, particularly when it comes to promotion and setting up their own business. We're also talking education and skills, Liverpool City Council cuts, and Liverpool City Council Business Cabinet member Dave Wade-Smith and his blueprint for the city, which he talked about earlier this week. To discuss this and more, I'm sure, I'm delighted to be joined in the studio today by female entrepreneur Moira Carminati, the principal of De La Salle Academy, Patrick Ferguson, and the events manager from Downtown Liverpool, Roger Jonas. Good morning to you all.
Morning, Frank.
Good morning. Frank.
Moira, long time no see.
I know. Where's the time gone?
I know. You're looking absolutely fabulous, as always.
Oh, thank you. You're so sweet.
Now, every time I see you, which is, you know, fairly regularly, really, it's, you know, at least once every few months, but every time I see you, you're doing something else. I was going to say something new, but you don't do something new. You continue to do all the other things that you were doing and just take on new projects.
That's
so
right, yeah.
What are you actually up to at the moment?
Never a dull moment. Well, I've still got Cubanita, La Cubanita, as you know, in Campbell Square, just off the bottom of Duke Street, which is the Cuban bar and restaurant. So that's still going strong. And actually, funnily enough, I was just saying how, you know, amazing in the past couple of weeks, where from nowhere, suddenly there's loads of inquiries for summer parties. So people are clearly getting in the groove at the moment and looking forward to some brightness and, you know, a little bit more upbeat, which is good news. I've also got Garcia's, which is in the corner of Victoria Street, used to be the old River Bar, and soon to open Redhead's Piano Bar. So there's a few things going on in there and that side. And in addition to that, my other hat is Business Solutions, which you've known me wearing that hat for many years, Frank. I think, gosh, 15 years now. I can't believe where it's gone. But there we go. And all good stuff. And I'm actively involved at the moment in recruiting specialist skills for Saudi, more in asset integrity. So it's actually quite dangerous because I might sound like I know what I'm talking about, which would not be a good thing. So that's really specifically in oil and gas construction and also on the nuclear side, but mostly around safety and risk. So it's really great. I'm really enjoying it. And it kind of beats sort of discussing the price of chicken, you know.
Well, yeah, you could
chicken.
The oil and gas. He could do the hot air bit for you.
Oh,
not a problem at all. Anytime. And the other thing I was going to say to you, Moira, you don't have to be concerned about not really knowing the detail of anything in the Middle East, because the government don't, do they?
Well, you know, if this week's anything to go by. I think there's a lot of propaganda going on out there as well, mind you, at the moment. But because I've been trying to sort of get a feel exactly how it's going to impact, if at all, on the recruitment side, because we're looking at a big project, a 7-year project based in Saudi, and Saudi's quite constrained, as you would imagine. So I'm getting practice wearing the long black robe, you know, covering up the face, but that's going to be a positive for many, you know. So, but I've been sort of testing the water to see, you know, how do people feel about taking up positions in the Middle East, obviously, at the moment, because it's a bit of a concern, thinking, my goodness, we've got this big project, a 7-year project, and, you know, are we going to get the people to go out there? But in fact, you know, especially with Saudi, there's not the same concern, because although we've had the issues in Bahrain, you know, it is still across the bridge. And at Al Khobar in the eastern province of Saudi, there's a lot of control, And but the other side of it is, you know, you're looking at trillions and trillions of dollars worth of oil, and they're not going to let that be upset by anybody or anything. Mm. So I don't think you're going to see the same unrest as, say, in Libya, where there's a lot of, you know, political wranglings going on. But that's only my, you know,
bystander view. No, I think you're right. I think politically, Saudi has always been relatively stable, hasn't it, in that part of the world. But let me ask you about attitudes of the people that you're trying to recruit. Because you've referred to it yourself there, you know, they have a very different culture, don't they, in Saudi Arabia. So does that present difficult challenges for you when you're trying to identify the right people for the jobs that you're looking to recruit for?
Yeah, well, it's funny you should say that, because I remember in doing the research, because obviously you're still researching the market, and it's very much a global market. So I'm fishing in a global pond, basically, for the skills, because all the skills don't necessarily come from the UK. You know, you're looking at, you know, Africa, China, America, literally worldwide. And one of the things, if you go on to, say, for example, you can go on to a website for Saudi Aramco, which is the biggest oil company in Saudi Arabia. If you go onto their website, it'll give you a real flavour. Because I remember going on looking, saying, there's definitely a catch in this. You know, it looks fantastic. And it is fantastic. But it was like an advert for, you know, a holiday company. So it's showing, you know, all the water sports, horse riding, you know, this sport and whatever. And I thought, hang on a second, there's clearly a catch here. You know, this is too glossy, too good to be true. And of course, what it is, it's the constraints, if you like, for families. So whilst the guys will go out, and this is very much, you know, is a male-dominated thing here. And while we're going to talk about, you know, women in business later, it's still very much a male-dominated business. But there are so many constraints, and working within that sort of structure has its limitations. So it has its limitations in recruiting, because guys that go out there wouldn't necessarily want to move out there for 7 years, for example. Mm. I think the gloss of that all went off from years ago, when people all floated out to the Gulf, made lots of money, and then came back. But now I think it's a different market. And, you know, to take people out there and families, you are living in a compound. Mm. You are living in, and that's not for everybody. Mm. And it is a challenge. So you're not necessarily getting people to up sticks and move out, especially to Saudi as opposed to Dubai.
Yeah,
Dubai is a lot more international.
Although I guess the economic climate here at the moment is a positive for you when you're looking to recruit in that regard?
Well, for sure, because, I mean, the money's still there. Mm. You know, you're talking, and these particular skills that we're looking for, they're all six-figure salaries, plus, you know, tax-free benefits, and then all the accommodation and the rest of it that goes with it. But there is still a resistance to take the family out there. Mm. Because for a woman in Saudi, you know, it's not an easy life. Mm. Some would say, well, I'd love that life. It's like living in a hotel. But, you know, living in a hotel is all right for a while, but not all the time.
Yeah, you soon get fed up with that, too.
You know, so it depends, you know, what you're looking for. Mm. So there are still some constraints there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Patrick Ferguson, principal of De La Salle Academy. So what does that entail then?
Well, opening a new academy. We opened on January the 1st, but we've taken over from what was an outstanding humanities college, and I was the head teacher there, so I've transferred from being the head teacher of the humanities college to the principal now of the new academy. We got an opening event, even though we opened on January the 1st, we got a formal opening event this 11th of March, and well, I've got a £7.2 million building project with about £3 million worth of other funding. So there's a lot of work to be done. There's tremendous expectation in the community. It's all about transformation of the education agenda. Lots and lots of opportunities. And, of course, the day-to-day running of a new academy, which employs a lot of people. And there's a lot of young people that are relying on us getting the job done every single day to the highest possible standards. Mm. So it does keep us busy.
Whereabouts in Liverpool is the academy?
We're located in Croxteth on Dwerry House Lane, and we've been there since 1952. Buildings are well established, but in need of a bit of upgrade. So, the money will come in. It'll be very useful, and we can spend it well.
And that £7.2 million that you referred to, is that part of the Building Skills for the Future initiative?
No, it's totally separate. Okay. Sadly, the Building Schools for the Future project was withdrawn, but parallel with that, all the time has been a separate track, which was that if schools and local authorities wanted to nominate schools to become academies, they could do so. And that's an entirely separate fund of money. So that comes directly from the department. And you have to bid for that and compete for that. So it's very competitive.
And what is the, forgive my ignorance, but what's the difference between a school, sixth form college, say, and the academy that you've established? What are the sorts of different things that you would offer and provide?
There are a lot of differences, and some of them are technical differences and some of them are quite major differences. But the fundamental difference is this, that as a local school, a local secondary school, whether you're a county school or a faith-based voluntary-aided school, you would be under the control of the local council. And the theory behind academies is that you become a publicly funded independent school, and therefore you set up a new company, the De La Salle Trust, and we have a board of governors, and I'm one of those governors, and we are the employer, and we determine our curriculum, and we are totally responsible for the investment and the outputs in terms of pupil achievement and what we're about day to day, directly to the government who fund us. And we have some very, very tough targets to meet. So it's about being independent and being able to set our own agenda and respond to local need. And although schools are the same generally all over the country, what makes the difference in many cases is being able to respond specifically to the special needs in particular communities. And that's what an academy allows you to do.
Am I also right in saying that there is an encouragement for academies to engage more closely with the private sector?
Oh, absolutely. Fundamentally, there are two types of academies. And in the beginning, there was what we call type one academies, sponsored academies, where to establish an academy, you would link up with some business partners, several business partners, and they would become your sponsors. And then they would have a big say in appointing the governors. And in most cases, those would be failing schools, which another solution had to be found. And the solution in some cases was to establish an academy. And they then would appoint the principal and new staff. And it would, if you like, be a new beginning for that community. We were not in that position. We were judged outstanding by Ofsted in our recent inspection, and we got 33 out of something like 35 points we were graded as outstanding, which is quite unique in the country. And then along with that, we were invited to become an academy. And Lord Adonis came to visit the school, and he said, would you consider becoming an academy? And that was very exciting. So if you like, there was BSF and there was the academy track. And I'll be honest, you know, you become very anxious and nervous when you're leaving a very good relationship with a very good local authority like Liverpool, and to go it out on your own and to take full control and be responsible and all that goes with that. So we decided as a team of governors and staff, and the positives out of this, we were able to transfer all our teaching and non-teaching staff through the TUPE arrangements. Every single person moved across from De La Salle Humanities College across to the academy. Not one single person had their conditions of service changed. And when you are able to organise it like that and make that smooth transition, and we're a big employer in the area, then that's a tremendous winner, because everybody then can benefit from that. And so from there, we've just gone strength to strength. And the staff work very hard. They're highly motivated. And I think that's really what we need in our schools, to be places where children feel that we're working for them.
Absolutely. And I mean, Croxteth obviously has got a mixed reputation. I think that's fair to say. I don't think anybody would particularly argue with me as far as that's concerned. So there must be some specific challenges in that area there, in terms of the social inclusion agenda, in terms of ensuring that kids in Croxteth, the pupils that you teach, attain the highest possible standards. Do you consider what potential career opportunities there are going to be for your students and pupils when you're putting your curriculum together? Does that independent status enable you to be a bit more flexible as far as that's concerned?
Okay, well, there's several points to your question there. Great, great points there. First of all, let's just go back and visit Croxteth as an area. What I can say, and I've been the head teacher and now the principal in the area, working in the area, and the one thing that comes across day in, day out, is that in schools, and I've worked in many city schools, is that all parents want something. It's very simple, very fundamental, irrespective of where you live. They want the very best for their children. And it's no different in Croxteth. They put a great deal of trust in you as a school or an academy, as a head teacher or a principal, that you will deliver on that promise. And I make that promise every time I meet with parents in July and say, this is a great school. It's a school where we can take your son, because we're an all-boys school apart from girls in the sixth form, and we can stretch them and we can make them reach their potential, whether that's an academic route or a vocational route. So then leading on to how much control have we got over that? Well, we've always had a great deal of flexibility. I mean, we have, and we were a specialist humanities college, and we became that because we were a leading school in the city for English, and so humanities, geography, history, English, and we're seeing now the rise of these subjects and the new EBAC that's been promoted. So we're already there. In terms of further specialism, well, we've decided that the area that we would like to further develop, if you like, the niche market, but also sources of, you know, employment and career paths and opportunities post 16, we've decided we will specialise in the media. And so we've become Merseyside's first media academy. And we've got most, I think, of the big media players across Merseyside to be in negotiation with us and in dialogue with us about supporting that. Mm. And if you are to deliver a specialism and you're to engage young people in learning, it can only be really, really successful if we're doing something that they perceive is worthwhile and that there's a reason for it and they want to do it. Now, let me tell you, media is very, very popular. Mm. You talk about children manipulating images, recording audio and mixing it and producing their own multimedia work. I'll tell you what, that grabs them. Mm. And you can then use that as a vehicle to deliver an exciting curriculum in lots of other subject areas. Mm. So what we're doing is we're building on our strengths, the humanities college, the English, and then we're looking at this niche market, but also there is a vibrant media community in this city. Mm. So yes, there's lots of opportunity. We've got an eye on the job market and vocational pathways and university pathways, academic pathways, and all of that comes into the mix. And I think that's been part of our success.
Mm. And it's not a bad hook to have because, you know, there's some great opportunities in that particular industry sector if you stretch it as well to include the likes of the gaming industry and so on, which is strong in Merseyside and across the northwest region. Then you've got Merseyside City and Salford, of course. So lots of, hopefully, positive opportunities to come from there. I want to move us on to the subject I mentioned in the intro. High-profile companies have been given an obligatory two-year time frame to increase the number of women they have on their boards in order to avoid facing government quotas. Former Trade Minister Lord Davis has drawn up a report suggesting that a fifth of the 350 FTSE board members should be women by 2013, rising to a quarter by 2015. In addition, other research has shown that only 14% of UK businesses are owned by women, compared to 41% in the United States. Now, Moira, we've mentioned your varied career and the many businesses that you've been involved in. I have to say, managed and run and owned. So do those statistics surprise you?
Not at all. I mean, going back many years ago, I was sales director in financial services business. And in that time, I would be hard pushed to think of any other female, sales directors in the same sector. Within financial services, there were still a lot of females at board level or at a very senior level in different aspects of it. But within the sales force is very, very few. So, and that's, gosh, Frank, that's 20 years ago, you know, so I was only a baby, you can tell. But
you were only an apprentice.
Aye. But, you know, at that time, I would say, you know, because I've been looking at some reports that have come up lately about this gender gap. And it's not new. It's not new. It's always been like that. And I remember at the time there had been a downturn in the sector. And a lot of the companies within financial services, as an example, started to contract. And therefore, the salaries actually started to drop a little bit anyway, naturally because of the contraction of the market. However, there would have been a difference between what I, as a sales director, and bear in mind, it was 1,200 sales force with offshore development areas as well. So it wasn't anything, it wasn't just a tiny little sales force. But there would have been a significant difference than in my salary than perhaps my predecessor. But I don't know whether, I mean, it didn't really bother me. I just got on and did the job in hand. I think knowing that the sector was contracting made that probably a little bit easier. Maybe if it hadn't been, it would have been a different kettle of fish. So I don't know. You know, it's not new. It's not new. And it is, those facts are right. They've come up in the Northwest Development Agency doing a report looking at trying to drive forward initiatives for women in business. And actually, they're in good company because just last week, the White House have actually issued a report, which I find is absolutely hilarious, which is a federal report on the status of women, you know. So I'm not sure quite where they're going with that, whether Michelle Obama's got something to do there, a hand in that. But apparently it's the first in 50 years. So they've never actually really gone down that route. Mm. And there's a, you know, trying to close a gender gap there as well. But I always get a little bit tetchy on that because I'm always a little bit wary of going along to some of these things and it becoming hijacked by, you know, feminist views. So there is finding a, you know, a balance really into these things.
I was going to ask you really what you felt the, because I agree with you, I don't think there's anything new in this latest government report and the problem has been around for a long time. But I think the first thing I would say is I do believe it is a problem. I think if you're almost excluding the majority of our population, which is what women are, then, you know, there must be something that we're not doing quite right. And I think that when I talk to women, they will describe things that as guys you don't really consider or think about. So I think that, you know, first and foremost, I would say childcare provision would be the major barrier. You know, I would always say if you're bringing up a family, that would be the problem. And therefore, you know, big investments into education, particularly for under fives during the last government. And, you know, you would have thought that would have an impact. Then a woman will say to me, and again, something that a lot of guys don't think about, and perhaps we should, well, that's great, you know, because then we can go to work 9 to 5. But actually, if you're really wanting to get on in your career, what do you do as a guy? And of course, what we do is we go out for a drink after work, we socialise, we do the weekend stuff. Yeah. Lots of fellas, not me, play golf, we do the football. All those things that we just do automatically, women have to have a far different take on that, don't they?
Well, you definitely need to have some sort of infrastructure there to help support. And I think back to the days way back when, as I say, when I was in financial services, and that was because it was national and the offshore. And I remember at that time thinking to myself, you know, why don't the government try and put some sort of child support, you know, funding in place, because at that time there was nothing. And I remember that I used to think, gosh, you know, I work and I was on a good salary compared to the average person. So I, you know, I was blessed in that respect. You know, I worked many, many hours, long hours. And my kids actually appreciated that. They used to actually stick up for their mother, basically saying, but my mum does this, you know, she's got this kind of position. And they were really good. But it cost me an absolute fortune in childcare because I had to have somebody who would take them in the morning. I was in London, dash up to London, come back, and I was all over the place. And really, I think if you weren't of a strong character, you'd go to bits because I have no family. So therefore, I didn't have a family infrastructure to help support. So I was totally dependent on, you know, private resources, basically, and finding a really good childminder and almost having a bed and breakfast rate if they had to stay over. But, you know, we got through it. But things have improved. And I think, you know, whilst they've brought in family tax credits and different things to help that, I think that's a big step forward. But you're right, you know, you know it is about the after hours socialising, and it's not that straightforward. But that's particularly worse, I guess, if you're a single parent rather than, you know, of a, you know, a full household really there to support. It's a bit of give and take.
But there's also, again, I don't want to generalise too much here, but I do think there's more of an emotional drag on the female in a relationship, whereas guys will more likely to say, well, it's okay because the mum's at home looking after them. You know, a lot of women would say, well, okay, the dad's there, but actually I haven't seen the kids for a few days, so I'm still going to go home anyway.
Yes, you hard-hearted guys, that's what it is. I think it is true, actually. I think that's a valid point. But, but I think the other things as well in terms of people getting on and driving is about individuals and confidence and the ability to negotiate. And I think that that's, you know, there are different aspects. There's, if you like, the family infrastructure and that sort of social side, but there's also the other skill set that perhaps some women don't have or could do with, you know, building on. And if you look at, if you like, initiatives that try to help women get into business, in a lot of situations they're around kind of mentoring and coaching, which is fine and all very nice and cuddly. You know, and you do need some of that. You've got to give people a route to be able to move forward. But if you look through a lot of these support mechanisms that, you know, Business Link and the, you know, the different bodies would come up with, I think you'd be hard pushed to find anything that had hardcore negotiation skills and things that actually help you take that leap forward into a different area within in corporate life. In particular, and I think that that's missing. I think there's a lot of gaps there, and you know, that could help women achieve more.
I think that's a great point, actually. And there's something that the Development Agency did start to develop just towards the end of the last Labour government, which was called the High Growth Programme, which has now been taken over by a company called Winning Pitch, and that does that very sort of I would call hard-nosed business support.
Yeah.
And I think that is important. But just a final point from you, Moy, on this. Do you think that actually part of the problem is men in the boardroom who do find it difficult to deal with strong, independent, good women?
I think there is a balance there on that. There is certainly an element of that, Frank, and I know that I came across that way back in my days in the boardroom, and you know, I laughed it off because being a hard-nosed Scot, you know, I remember, I think I've mentioned this to you in the past, that my chief exec, all the guys were in complete fear of, they would never admit it, but they were, because if he ever asked for a report or certain questions, they would give him what he wanted to hear. And I thought, well, what's going on here? You know, why are you giving all this bull when actually that is not the situation? Tell it how it is. So he used to say to me, you know, Moira, you progressed and held your own amongst these guys, basically, because you weren't a shrinking violet. You were prepared to call it how it was. So that does intimidate a lot of blokes. There's for sure that really does intimidate. And I had so many knives attempted to be thrown in my back, never in my front, always in my back. And I can think of a few people that had Teflon-coated armour basically around them who were basically intimidated. But, you know, then on the other front, you can't let that hold you back. But yeah, there is. But on the other hand, there's a friend of mine, Gordon Beattie, who's got a very, very successful communications company based in London and actually all around the UK. And Gordon, we were commenting basically on women in business, or somebody had made a comment, and he has got three women on his board, I suppose, and one man. So I said, I don't know if it was a brave move or a crazy move, So he opted for brave, but I think he was being politically correct there.
Well, I have to say, before I set my own business up, I work for six or seven different people, managed by six or seven different people, including politically. I would include Louise Elman, who is leader of Lancashire County Council, whilst I was there for a number of years. And I have to say that female bosses, I always found, were far better in terms of being clear in expectations, goals, objectives, and also have much more clarity in terms of being able to identify where your strengths and weaknesses are. So, you know, I've never, ever felt that there was a problem in terms of the ability of women. Mm. But I think we do have a culture in this country that needs to be addressed. And hopefully, although, as you said, Moira, this isn't necessarily anything new, the report will at least stimulate some new thinking around what has been a long-term problem. We've run out of time for the first part of this morning's programme. We'll be back in a moment talking City Council's cuts and David Wade-Smith's blueprint for the future of the city.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back to the programme. I'm joined this week in the studio by Moira Carmeniti. That's right, isn't it, Moy?
Close.
Go on, you say. Oh, that's it. Sounds so
it's
much
close.
Better when you say it. Who is a female entrepreneur up to all sorts of things, as she was telling us about the first part of the programme. Roger Jonas, who is the events manager at Downtown Liverpool, and the principal of De La Salle Academy, Patrick Ferguson. Patrick, we were talking before the break about encouraging more female business owners and females into the higher echelons, if you like, of the boardroom. You were mentioning the fact that in your sixth form, you have females, you have girls there. Is there anything that you think particularly the education system can do to encourage young women into enterprise and running their own business?
Well, I think you've touched on a very important point there, Frank, because we, as a nation, we tend to focus on leaving education and training and going out and working for somebody else. And if you go across and you look at what's happening in the US, where it's a very much an entrepreneurial environment, it's not unusual for young people to leave education and to establish their own business, where the risks are less, let's face it, and it's easier in some respects to do it. So let's just not worry too much about the gender divide at the point where they leave school. It's about actually getting that message across that actually you could be the next Alan Sugar, you could be the next big employer in the area, you know, the new developer, the new creator of enterprise and opportunity. And we don't do that very well as a nation. Mm. But again, moving to what message do we convey to our students, we convey the same message to all our students, and that is, go for it. Work damned hard. Go for it. Raise your sights. Have high expectations. Be demanding. Be demanding of us as the teachers in the school. And really take do not take no for an answer. Just be very demanding and set your sights high.
Do you think kids generally in school are exposed enough to successful individuals and entrepreneurs? Do we do enough to encourage engagement with people who may have in their own business been successful? I mean, in Croxteth, for example, we are involved with the Flanagan Group, who, successful construction company, also own a number of leisure bars, restaurants, hotels in the city centre and elsewhere. Do you think there's a place for people like that to visit the likes of De La Salle for a couple of hours and say, look, kids, you know, we were from here, and we weren't blessed with the best academic results in the world, and those guys would be the first to tell you that, but we've still managed to set up a successful business and have a fantastic lifestyle on the back of it. That's those sort of role models, I suppose, I'm talking about.
Sure.
Other than, you know, the and nothing against these guys, but, you know, the Steven Gerrards and the Abby Clancy's, the people that the kids will see every other day in the newspapers. I'd much prefer my children to be actually looking at, you know, as I say, the likes of the Flanagans and saying, I can do that.
Yes, absolutely. But there's two parts to this. One is local success stories that, you know, homegrown, as it were. But there's also exposing youngsters to national success, so people that have done very well and they're national names and not necessarily local, because you want them to come in. You want to broaden the horizon for these youngsters, because let's face it, many of them live for a long time and don't travel far in their locality, and that's their early experience in life. And if we are to give them this good start in life, it's about this raising the expectation. So, yes, fine, bring in local entrepreneurs, people that have done well. But also let's not forget that there's a whole range of other people out there that have got a lot to offer. And schools and colleges and academies will welcome these people. You know, our doors are open. I think the tension there is that you as business people and employers are very, very busy. And I think the day job in schools is about doing well with youngsters in terms of delivering a curriculum, a high-quality curriculum, and all the pastoral care that you need to provide there to make sure that works. And I think the balancing act that we've got to be able to achieve is to do all of that in the amount of time that we've got. So our doors, we're no different than anybody else, are always open. We would invite people in. And I suppose that's one of the strengths early on of academies, where you had these business partners and they were part of your academy, that you had ready access to them, perhaps more so than organisations that were not academies. But that is changing.
Well, you mentioned the phrase there, raising expectations, and David Wade-Smith, who is the City Council's business member on the Cabinet, has been talking to the Liverpool Daily Post this week about what he thinks Liverpool's expectations ought to be going forward, and said some very interesting things. David has been on this programme on a number of occasions and has expressed the view that he thinks Liverpool over the last decade has transformed almost unrecognisably from where we were, certainly back in the 80s, and probably in the early 90s as well. However, he expresses and articulates the view very well this week, I think, that perhaps Liverpool hasn't been as predominant as it ought to have after the very successful 2008 European Capital of Culture, which we hosted, and maybe it's time for some fairly radical changes to take place within some of the agencies and institutions that govern the city. Mostly he was talking about the merger of Liverpool Vision and the Mersey Partnership. And again, just for the listeners' information, Downtown Liverpool undertook a poll of business leaders in the city over the last 3 weeks and found that 76% of businesses believe that those two organisations, that's TMP and Liverpool Vision, should merge. But he also went on to say that he believes the knowledge economy, and whatever that means, again, Patrick, we may seek your views on this in a moment, is the area that Liverpool really needs to focus on. Roger, somebody who's spoken to David at length on numerous occasions and was involved in the launch of the new One Liverpool card on Thursday afternoon with Dave Wade-Smith through his company LiveSmart. I don't suppose there's anything particularly new in what he said, but he's really stuck his head above the parapet, hasn't he?
I think he has, and I think David is very good at doing that. And I think one of the reasons that David is very good at doing that is because he's confident in his knowledge about the city. He's had his finger in many pies in the city and has done great things for Liverpool. He stuck his head out. He's said that we've got an opportunity to get it right, but that's going to take some very, very bold decisions. I haven't met anybody who can quote facts and figures quite like David can. And he is. He's the oracle in terms of knowledge of Liverpool. And I think he's somebody that we should listen to. Don't necessarily have to agree with everything that David says. But he has a way, like yourself sometimes, Frank, of pointing things out that you might skirt over, sometimes pointing out the obvious in a way that actually penetrates the consciousness of people. And I think because of his vast knowledge and his understanding and his eloquent way of putting things, we need to listen to him. Maybe there is nothing new. We're not reinventing the wheel. His talk about merging the Mersey Partnership and Vision, as you say, is something that we focused on an awful lot. And I think a way of looking at it is in some ways there's been a lot of criticism that they're both doing the same thing, and the transparency of the outcomes has not been out there for everybody to see. So I think there's a confusion, not just from the business community, but also from the residents and citizens of Liverpool, what is happening for the amount of investment that's being made. The investment that has been made into the Mersey partnership needs to be turned into an asset. And if that means merging it with Vision, then so be it. But again, it's that thing, it's the old adage of what's the best way to kill a dog? Mm. Make two people responsible for feeding it. And I think that is what a lot of people are thinking is happening with Vision and TMP.
Mm. I mean, that touches on another thing that I wanted to just briefly discuss today, because Liverpool City Council and the cuts that they're facing, £191 million needs to be found over the next 3 years. I believe that's the ballpark figure, maybe slightly more, maybe slightly less. We've discussed this at length, so I don't want to focus too much on it. But again, we had Max Steinberg to an event on Thursday morning. He's the chief executive of Liverpool Vision. Mm-hmm. Max was reminding us of the place Liverpool found itself in the early 80s, because he worked alongside Michael Heseltine, who became at that time the Minister for Merseyside. And Max was saying Liverpool at that time was absolutely in the vanguard of opposition to central government, Margaret Thatcher's government at the time, and it didn't really do the city any favours. Despite the fact that Joe Anderson and other council leaders, in fact, even up until I think it was the day of the budget, Warren Bradley had sort of been saying that they were all signed off for this consistent budget agenda of cuts, there has still been some fallout and criticism, obviously, of central government, but nowhere near the acrimony that we experienced in the 80s. Mm. And again, Roger, just going on the back of what Max was saying, that's probably for the good, isn't it? We don't really want to be seen as the basket case that we were back then.
No, it's always hard when you know, maybe I'm being devil's advocate here, but, you know, Liverpool has a reputation for being quite unique in the people that live here. Oh God, I'm probably going to get criticised here, but you know, Boris Johnson said a while ago that Liverpool people wear their heart on their sleeve. I'm not sure that you know.
I think what he said was we were a bunch of whingers. I think that's what he said.
But I think that's where we've seen a massive change. I mean, again on Thursday, Max was talking about the perception of Liverpool from inside the UK, and the perception from Europe. And we've talked about this an awful lot. I think it's about attitude. It's about the change of attitude. And again, as David says, it's about making those bold decisions. We don't want to go back to the way it was in the 80s. And I remember it well. I remember it. It was a horrendous time. Economically, we battled in Liverpool against Margaret Thatcher. Certain people did. I don't think we're going back to that. I think we've got to take a reality check here and look at some of the decisions that Cameron and his coalition have made. You know, Liverpool has to change. Every city is struggling. Every city is being hit by the same cuts. It's about now how we address that. And can we learn from the past? Are we going to learn from the past? Is radical change needed? I don't see there's any way that we can get around the being radical change. You can't take the volume of cuts that are happening, certainly in the public sector, the number of people, the redundancies that are going to be made, and not have to restructure and reorganise the business model of how the city is run. We've spent a lot of money on Shanghai. We've spent a lot of money, cost neutral, it doesn't matter where the money's come from, in delivering the embassy. And the whole idea is to attract investment into the city. One of the criticisms which has to be addressed, and it has to be addressed for those two initiatives to be effective, is getting the business model right. We can't have people coming here with a big sack of money and then finding brick walls all the way along through the administration and through the bureaucracy of the public sector, because they're going to take that money elsewhere. And that is my biggest fear of the administration and the decisions that are not being made at the moment.
And again, I think Max Steinberg was great in terms of saying it's not just about Liverpool, saying it's business friendly. It's got to demonstrate that in every sense of the word or of the words. Patrick just mentioned the knowledge economy there, which means an awful lot of things to an awful lot of people, dependent upon who you talk to. But Liverpool's got some great universities, obviously some great academies, some great colleges and schools as well. Are we strong in the area of things like science, research and development? Is that an area where Liverpool and its city region can actually start to develop some real opportunities and jobs, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. But you've got to remember, knowledge economy means different things to different people, and it's different again when you're in the world of education. But just picking up Shanghai, I mean, I had students out in Shanghai. I visited the Liverpool Pavilion. I was very proud of the city. And they use some multimedia information kiosks there, making the best use of new technology to sell the city. And I was really proud to be part of that and go out there and see the city doing that. But if you go to countries like Japan, what you see in Japan is you see large broadband providers like Yahoo, and they're putting broadband into every home at 100 megabit speed. Now, what have we got in this country? What's our infrastructure? If you look at the mobile phone market in Japan in regard to learning and education, you'll find that there is another tier of communication, and they're developing new protocols so that learning can take place truly anywhere, anytime. And it's mobile devices that don't actually exist yet, but the infrastructure and the protocols are being developed so that if you want to learn a language, or you want to learn how to, you know, at a simple level, say, change the brakes on your car, it'll be displayed on your device, and then you'll ask a question, and the information server will give you the information, and it will adapt what it gives you according to how you're asking that question and the progress you're making. So whether it's financial intelligence or something as mundane as a task in a local tyre depot, the knowledge economy is going to have a massive impact. And I suppose the challenge for us in education, whether it be academies, schools or universities, is to harness the best of that technology, because there's a huge amount of it out there. And it's to say, I can use that and that and that, because I've only got a budget which will allow me to make the investment in some of that technology. So we've had to make choices, and we've obviously got a substantial investment in new technology, and we're working with world-class information technology providers at this moment. And the challenge is to pick the right technology so that it will have the greatest learning impact on the young people and other learners, because as an academy, we've got other learners, not just night school, that traditional pattern for learning, but also we've got young mums with, say, young children who would like to come back into the world of work. They missed out on education at quite an early stage. And our curriculum that we would offer traditionally, say, at Key Stage 3 to some of our younger pupils, is an ideal entry point that's not too frightening, if you like, if you want to re-engage. So a lot of our learning material is available on the web, but we're developing that technology now so that it is more interactive. So that's where we're going. That's going to be our contribution. That's the challenge for us as an academy.
And on that very positive note, Patrick, I'm afraid, almost run out of time. It just leaves me the opportunity to say thank you very much to Moira. I've never seen her as quiet, the second part of that programme. To Patrick, and to, I know, we'll get you back on, don't worry. And to Roger, thanks to my producer, Jonathan Dean. Most of all, thank you for listening. Have a great week, and don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9. Listen and log on to great music and great conversation on City Talk 105.9.